Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Monday, March 1st. I'm your reader, Bob Young. We're expecting sunshine today, and a little bit cooler with a high of 31 degrees, winds north from 7 to 14 miles per hour. Tonight, under clear skies, will cool down to 14 degrees. As we look around the region, sunshine today, clear tonight. Windy tomorrow with plenty of sun. Wednesday, mostly sunny and mild. Thursday, mostly sunny. Friday, a blend of sun and clouds. We've had no precipitation in the last 24 hours, and so far this month, we've had 1.02 inches. We have three lead stories on the front page today. Love in the time of COVID, COVID-19 jobless fraud rampant, and online and on a roll. We'll begin with love in the time of COVID. In pandemic, more teens find themselves facing dating violence. Stories filed by Amy Rivers, Waterloo. Accusing you of things you didn't do. Not wanting you to spend time with your own family. Constantly texting you to find out what you're up to. Telling you what to do or even what to wear. All of those are warning signs you might be in an unhealthy relationship. And they're all red flags that teenagers in particular should watch out for, said Lisa Ambrose, CEO at Amani Community Services in Waterloo. Quote, we see a lot of females being stalked by their boyfriends or technology abuse, texting, threatening to send pictures when they break up, Ambrose said. Quote, now things are not looking like it was in the beginning, unquote. That's especially true for the black women Amani serves, Ambrose said. They experience domestic abuse at a rate 4 times higher than white women. But because kids normalize what they see, plus face cultural stigma about talking about those things, they're also less likely to know they're in an unhealthy relationship, let alone seek help. Quote, we're trying to do a better job with our teens and healthy relationships and what that looks like, Ambrose said. High school students trying out what their first romantic relationships look like is a normal part of adolescence. What's changed is they've had to navigate those issues while also dealing with the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic and things like virtual education, which has disrupted some of the in-school support available. That includes Success Street, located in both Waterloo High Schools, as well as George Washington Carver Middle School, and serves students from around the Cedar Valley, said Success Street manager Joni Spencer. Quote, now that students are back on site, our numbers are completely increased, Spencer said. What's great about the school-based health centers is they may be coming for mental health counseling, but that counselor is going to screen for healthy relationships, unquote. Providers from Amani, Riverview Center, or Waypoint Services then come to the school to meet with teens, a crucial component when a student may not have a trusted adult to talk to or reliable transportation. It's also valuable from the school's standpoint of keeping them on track to graduate. Quote, when you have dating violence on your mind or an unhealthy relationship on your mind, you're sitting in a classroom, you're not learning as well as you could if you've got all that on your mind, Spencer said. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, a Republican who represents Iowa's 1st District, joined a bipartisan coalition in co-sponsoring a House resolution designating February as Teen Dating Violence Awareness and Prevention Month last week. The resolution has not yet passed. I'm trying to raise 2 young boys into great men, and we're having lots of conversations about respect, Hinson said of her sons. This is about our next generation and making sure our young people don't get into trouble and find themselves in an unhealthy situation, unquote. Besides the resolution, a largely symbolic measure, Hinson said she thought Congress should be looking at what programs are out there that can help, pointing to CDC stats showing 1 in 11 high school girls and 1 in 15 high school boys have experienced physical dating violence in the U.S. She noted that number has been increasing. Quote, I see this as a public health issue. How can we be working with our public health departments to make sure we're taking care of our youngest generation, Henson said. Advocates say putting money into programs like theirs can help. Quote, to have someone to talk to and have those positions paid for, whether it's federal funding or state funding, that's going to alleviate that, Spencer said. Quote, if you want to invest in something, invest early and make sure those services and resources are available, unquote. Online and on a roll, story filed by Melody Parker, and it begins with a photograph where we see three students gathered around a large screen watching a program that's being projected. And the caption says, Waterloo School students are shown watching Voices from Ellis Island, one of the virtual programs from the Kaleidoscope series. Kaleidoscope series attendance soars via virtual performances. Cedar Falls, the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center Kaleidoscope series went virtual during the coronavirus pandemic and is on track to increase attendance by 32%. The series' mission is to provide young people multiple opportunities to experience a wide range of the performing arts through live performances in the Great Hall, quote, typically reach around 45,000 annually, said Amy Hunselman, Director of Education and Special Projects. When the season wraps up in April, she anticipates virtual programming will have reached 66,556 individuals. It's been amazing to see growth of the Kaleidoscope series as we've been able to extend beyond the Cedar Valley and Northeast Iowa. We've always been a presence in smaller communities with shows we take on the road, but jumping into a complete virtual experience has enabled us to serve more students and school districts and provide those art experiences, she said. She cites the quote, Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad, a drama with music about the abolitionist born into slavery who escaped and helped others to freedom. The show, which begins February 3rd and runs through March 26th, has already reached nearly 16,000 third through eighth graders. We're able to connect with students, teachers, and families throughout the United States and into Canada and even Jamaica. That particular title has reached more people out of state than in state, Hunselman said. So far, there have been 7,708 out-of-state viewers, 1,552 Canadian viewers, and 60 Jamaican viewers, compared with just under 6,300 Iowans logged in to watch. When the pandemic began last year, the Kaleidoscope series lost about 50% of its anticipated audience in March and April, Hunselman said. Through the summer, we had to figure out how we could provide resources for classroom learning. In our 20-year history, schools and teachers have relied on arts experiences to supplement classroom learning, unquote. National touring companies also had to decide how best to offer their titles to programs like the Kaleidoscope series. Iowa Arts Council, McElroy Trust, and the Guernsey Foundation made it possible for GBPAC to shift the series to a digital program. The season has included historical fare on such topics as Ellis Island, but the most popular shows are based on children's literature, including Miss Nelson Has a Field Day and Pete the Cat, which was seen by more than 10,000 Iowa pre-kindergartners through second graders and 334 out-of-state students. Little Red Hen, a country musical based on the children's classic book, concludes the series and is expected to be viewed by nearly 11,000 pre-kindergarten through third graders from March 8th through April 9th. Teachers like Danielle Mumothai from St. Paul's Lutheran School in Waverly have expressed their appreciation for the virtual shows. Her students watched Voices from Ellis Island, and in her comments said the program opened up conversations to how families arrive in America. Thank you for making these accessible to us during this weird year, unquote. One teacher said, thank you for allowing my virtual students to still feel like they're going on field trips that make them creative and enhancing journeys. And another noted, coming to the Gallagher is always such an exciting event and such a great connection to our classrooms. I am so glad we can still do it virtually, unquote. Amy Dietrich, a social studies teacher from the Philadelphia School District in Pennsylvania, said she was very thankful to have stumbled on this resource. We have been virtual since March, and I'm always looking to add a new layer to my teaching, unquote. In addition, the Kaleidoscope Storytime series has proven popular with thousands of viewers. Iowa artists and community members act as storytellers for popular children's books such as I Ain't Gonna Paint No More, Punk Farm, Froggy Builds a Treehouse, and My First Biography, Abraham Lincoln. The recorded read-aloud stories feature interactive elements. Virtual programming likely will remain a component of the series, Hunzelman said. Nothing can replace the live arts experience, but a virtual platform gives even the smallest Iowa communities an opportunity to see the arts come alive. Quote, we're eager to get back into the auditorium. As an industry, we're really thinking about what it's going to look like and feel like when we do, unquote. Virtual programming is free, but registration is required to access the link for viewing at www.gbpac.com. COVID-19 jobless fraud rampant. Fraud is rampant in COVID-related jobless programs. The story is filed by the Associated Press and begins with a photograph that shows a computer and a tablet that are logged into unemployment insurance website. And the caption says, web pages used to show information for collecting unemployment insurance in Virginia and reporting fraud and identity theft in Pennsylvania are displayed on the respective state web pages Friday in Pennsylvania. Columbus, Ohio. With the floodgates set to open on another round of unemployment aid, states are being hammered with a new wave of fraud as they scramble to update security systems and block scammers who already have siphoned billions of dollars from pandemic-related jobless programs. The fraud is fleecing taxpayers, delaying legitimate payments, and turning thousands of Americans into unwitting identity theft victims. Many states have failed to adequately safeguard their systems, and review by the Associated Press finds that some will not even publicly acknowledge the extent of the problem. The massive sham springs from prior identity theft from banks, credit rating agencies, healthcare systems, and retailers. Fraud perpetrators, sometimes in China, Nigeria, or Russia, buy stolen personal identity information on the dark web and use it to flood state unemployment systems with bogus claims. The U.S. Justice Department is investigating unemployment fraud by transnational criminal organizations, sophisticated domestic actors, and individuals across the United States, said Joshua Stuve, a spokesman from the department's criminal division. The Labor Department Inspector General's office estimates that more than $63 billion has been paid out improperly through fraud or errors, roughly 10% of the total amount paid under coronavirus pandemic-related unemployment programs since March. Quote, we are all learning that there's an epidemic of fraud, said U.S. Representative Kevin Brandy of Texas, the ranking Republican on the House's Powerful Ways and Means Committee. Brady said the $63 billion estimate is larger than the entire budget of the Department of Homeland Security, unquote. These are frightening levels of fraud, he said. California has been the biggest target, with an estimated $11 billion in fraudulent payments and an additional $19 billion in suspect accounts. Colorado has paid out nearly as much to scammers, an estimated $6.5 billion, as it has to people who filed legitimate unemployment claims. Other estimates, according to AP reporting across the states, range from several hundred thousand dollars in a smaller state, such as Alaska and Wyoming, to hundreds of millions in more populous states, such as Massachusetts and Ohio. The nationwide fraud has fed on twin vulnerabilities, a flood of jobless benefit applications since the pandemic began that has overwhelmed state unemployment agencies and antiquated benefit systems that are easy prey for crafty and persistent criminals. In Ohio, weekly first-time unemployment claims have ranged from 17,000 to more than 40,000 during the pandemic. But since late last March, those claims have topped more than 140,000 some weeks, with many of them believed to be fraudulent. The state has paid at least $330 million in fraudulent pandemic unemployment benefit claims. Trying to catch so many bogus claims delays payouts to Ohioans who are legitimately in need of help. The Columbus suburb of Upper Arlington, Cynthia Subertoli, was receiving $228 a week after she was laid off in March from her job with a nonprofit that runs high school student exchange programs. Her benefits were put on hold in January after she informed the state that someone had tried to use her identity in a scam to claim benefits. She thought the problem was resolved, but has yet to see a renewal of her benefit checks, which she and her husband used to help pay for a son's vision and auditory therapy. Quote, "It's just not a good way to take care of people," said Tibertoli, 49 years old. In Indiana, Kentucky, and Maryland, officials have said that for certain weeks in the new year, at least two-thirds of the claims they received were classified as suspicious due to problems verifying identities. It's not the first brush with serious fraud for Maryland. In July, officials said they discovered a massive criminal enterprise that had stolen more than $500 million in unemployment benefits. Among states that have been hardest hit are those participating in the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program adopted by Congress last year. It has been a lifeline for out-of-work freelancers and gig workers who normally don't qualify for unemployment insurance, but it's also been a boon for criminals who use stolen identities to make claims. Nearly 800,000 of the 1.4 million claims Ohio has received through this program have been tagged for potential fraud. Scams have been so widespread that the U.S. Department of Justice is setting aside money to hire more prosecutors. In New York alone, the Department of Labor says it has referred hundreds of thousands of fraud cases to federal prosecutors. The state says it has blocked $5.5 billion in fraudulent claims, while New Jersey says it's prevented $2.5 billion from flowing into the hands of criminals. Despite those efforts, a government watchdog agency says not enough states are taking the necessary steps to prevent fraud. In its memo this past week, the U.S. Department of Labor's Office of Inspector General said that by the end of last year, 22 of the 54 state and territorial workforce agencies were still not following its repeated recommendation to join a data exchange run by the National Association of State Workforce Agencies. That system is designed to check Social Security numbers used in claims to see if they're being used in multiple states or are linked to dead people or other scam methods. The office said it had found $5.4 billion in fraudulent payments from March through October. The biggest chunk of that, $3.5 billion, came through claims that used the same Social Security numbers in multiple states. One number was used on claims in 40 states. 29 of the states paid those claims, totaling more than $220,000. The department needs to take immediate action and increase its efforts to ensure states implement effective controls to mitigate fraud in those high-risk areas, the Inspector General warned labor officials. Turning to the Cedar Valley section, welcome to Iowa, a state in need of a slogan. Lawmakers take on highway signs greeting travelers. Story filed by Rob Bossart, and it begins with a photograph of a sign on an overhang over a roadway, and the sign says, "The people of Iowa welcome you. Iowa, field of opportunities." Des Moines. State lawmakers think Iowa needs to upgrade the image that greets motorists along highway entry points at the borders. Quote, "I'm kind of embarrassed that when you come into Iowa at every different angle, we've got different messaging," said Senator Kerry Colker, Republican of Dyersville. Quote, "We've got fields of opportunities. That's not even our state slogan anymore, unquote. Kolker, who works in tourism and economic development when the legislature is not in session, led a Senate Commerce subcommittee hearing last week on a bill she introduced that seeks $350,000 state general fund appropriation to remove Iowa's current 68 highway welcome signs and replace them with new, different, and distinct message boards. Quote, I filed this just to kind of start the conversation. This isn't obviously a hill that I plan to die on, but this is something I think is important that we make sure as a state that we upgrade our image, she said. I'm not shaming by any means our imaging or our branding. That's not what I'm trying to do with this. But I am trying to create a little bit of momentum, and maybe there are partners out there to make that happen. At first blush, the idea of giving Iowa an image makeover drew a positive bipartisan response, with subcommittee member Senator Tony Bisignano, Democrat of Des Moines, saying he would like to see the state use it as a way to engage young people by soliciting ideas from the public for a new welcome sign design similar to the way Iowa Department of Transportation sought proposals for license plate designs. Quote, I think it's always a good idea to put a new face and a fresh coat of paint, said Bisignano. I'd like to see Iowans design this. I don't think it ought to be a Madison Avenue design. Personally, if I had my way, it would be people under 21. I would want the young people to come up with it, and they had a piece of it. Steve Gent of the Iowa Department of Transportation said Iowa currently has 68 welcome signs at entry points along interstate, primary, and U.S. highways, 13 that are 16 feet by 14 feet overhead or side-mounted interstate signs, and 55 that are 8 feet by 7 feet signs, all but one with the message, "The people of Iowa welcome you," along with an image of the sun, a green slashy stripe with the word Iowa in cursive letters, and fields of opportunities. The only exception is a welcome sign entering Clinton via U.S. 30 that has a locally generated message, he noted. Anytime anybody is coming into Iowa on a primary highway, they're going to see one of those Welcome to Iowa signs, he said. Gent noted the signs have been up for about 19 years, dating to when former Governor Tom Vilsack unveiled the Field of Opportunity slogan at the 1999 Iowa State Fair, and likely need an upgrade given their life expectancy is about 20 years. He said officials from Iowa DOT, the Iowa Economic Development Authority, and the State Department of Cultural Affairs held preliminary discussions aimed at replacing the signs, but the discussion was shelved when the COVID-19 pandemic moved into Iowa about a year ago. At that time, the replacement cost estimate was about $275,000, he said. Part of Thursday's discussion focused on the fact that no one in attendance or participating via Zoom link knew Iowa's current slogan. Quote, I find it ironic that no one can say what the slogan is, said subcommittee member Mike Clemish, Republican of Spillville. Quote, it shows it needs some attention. Quote, Iowa's previous state slogan was Fields of Opportunities. Our state marketing campaign, which launched in 2019, is called This is Iowa, said Stacy Hupp Ballard, Chief Strategic Communications Officer for the State Economic Development Authority and the Iowa Finance Authority. She said the agencies view the work to refresh Iowa's welcome signs as an opportunity to renew the conversation on a state slogan for Iowa. Quote, we had to hit the pause button because of the pandemic and look forward to picking up where we left off, she added. Clearly, we think it's time to replace the signs and get a new, fresh slogan in there. We thank the senator for introducing it and moving it forward. Next, we have the Call the Courier column. Question, is there a Facebook page or a group for our area for vaccine hunters or people who stalk nearby pharmacies to get leftover COVID-19 vaccine doses that might otherwise be thrown away? Answer, we couldn't find any such pages. Question, why is Ron Steele no longer anchoring the 5 p.m. news? Answer, the longtime KWWL anchor is, quote, taking my first very small step toward retirement, he wrote in an August Facebook post announcing the decision. Quote, while this definitely represents a change for me, the time is right. Steele will continue to live anchor the 6 p.m. and the 10 p.m. newscasts, he noted, as well as host and produce The Steele Report, a taped news and public affairs show that airs at 10 a.m. on Sundays. Question, when you are told to keep a faucet running due to cold temps, do you keep all faucets running or just one? Does it matter if you have it on a warm or cold water? Answer, just one, if it's the right one. If you know where your water comes into your house, turn on a cold water faucet at the other end of the house to allow for water to travel through the entire system. If you aren't sure where the incoming water source is located, setting any faucet to drip will help. Question, why did President Biden shut down the pipeline? Answer, it's part of President Biden's plan to address climate change. Environmentalists opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline because of the oil sands crude it would have carried. Producing that oil requires extra processing that emits more of the greenhouse gases that contribute to climate change. Native American tribes and landowners in western states also had been fighting the project since almost as soon as it was unveiled over environmental concerns. Question, who is in charge of Iowa's vaccine distribution? Answer, ultimately, Governor Kim Reynolds. Vaccine distribution in Iowa is decided by state public health officials who are using guidance from the federal government. The state has formed an advisory committee of experts to provide guidance. Reynolds has been criticized for not having a statewide registration and call center established to coordinate distribution, but she is also reliant on the federal government to deliver doses. Insufficient allotment of doses has slowed the process of getting vaccine to those eligible to receive it in the early phases of the rollout. But the situation is improving weekly. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, March 1st on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's continue with local and national news, and then we'll turn to the sports page after that. Lawyer hired by Democratic Attorney General defends Iowa's GOP governor, filed by Ryan Foley of the Associated Press, Iowa City. Iowa's Democratic Attorney General has installed the Republican governor's lawyer into a high-level job in which he is aggressively defending his former boss's policy agenda and management decisions in court. Weeks after joining Attorney General Tom Miller's staff, Attorney Sam Langholz has participated in cases defending Governor Kim Reynolds' coronavirus restrictions, her law requiring a 24-hour waiting period for abortions, her denial of overtime pay to some nurses, and her administration's ouster of a longtime public health spokeswoman. The hiring incensed some Democrats and trial lawyers, but it generated goodwill for Miller, the nation's longest-serving attorney general, from a sometimes adversarial GOP-controlled legislature, and Reynolds, who called Langholz a brilliant legal mind, unquote. Miller and Reynolds announced Langholz's appointment as an assistant attorney general for civil and appellate litigation in November. The attorney general's office confirmed Tuesday that a top Miller aide, Solicitor General Jeff Thompson, designed the $140,000 per year job and hired Langholz without posting the opening. Thompson worked closely with Langholz during his 2.5-year stint as senior legal counsel to Reynolds and knew his abilities, said Miller spokesman Lynn Hicks. Quote, when we have someone of his talent and there is an opening, we hire him or her, Hicks said, noting that Langholz was first in his 2008 University of Iowa law school class. Langholz, a Republican loyalist who founded the Iowa chapter of the Federalist Society, could use the job to bolster his credentials if he again applies to become an Iowa Supreme Court justice after getting passed over last year. Despite having little prior litigation experience, he's a supervising attorney in the unit that defends the state against lawsuits and is already representing the Reynolds administration and the University of Iowa in high-profile cases. Langholz has already helped defend Reynolds' emergency public health restrictions to fight the coronavirus against a lawsuit brought by a bar owner who argued they violated her rights. In December, he filed a motion that argued the governor used her power and judgment to defend the lives and livelihoods of residents, a phrase Reynolds often uses. It portrayed the governor's response as driven by the latest science and public health guidance. Langholz also quickly began defending a 24-hour mandatory waiting period for abortions that Reynolds signed into law last year. A landmark 2018 Iowa Supreme Court ruling found that a previous 72-hour waiting period was unconstitutional. He recently asked a judge to consider the law's legality anew, saying it's different than the 2017 statute that justices found violated women's rights on a 5-2 vote. He noted the new waiting period is 2 days shorter and argued, quote, the abortion industry would be affected differently by the requirement today. Planned Parenthood is suing to block the law, noting it would require women to make 2 trips to health centers and delay abortion. Langholz is representing the governor and her spokesman, Pat Garrett, in a lawsuit brought by former Department of Public Health spokeswoman Polly Carver Kim, who says she faced retaliation for releasing routine public information during the pandemic. Carver Kim says she was forced to resign after releasing statistics showing Iowa abortions climbed 25% in 2019 after Reynolds pulled Iowa out of a federal family planning program. Langholz is defending Reynolds against a proposed class action lawsuit filed by registered nurses at state institutions who claim they've been wrongly classified as salaried employees and denied overtime pay. He does not have conflicts of interest in those cases under Iowa's ethical rules for attorneys because he's representing the same client he previously advised, Hicks said. Ethical rules will require that Langholz be disqualified from cases in which he'll likely be a witness. That may prevent him from participating in a wrongful termination case filed by former Department of Human Services Director Jerry Foxhoven. Foxhoven has claimed that Langholz and the governor's chief of staff fired him after Foxhoven questioned the legality of a funding arrangement. Tensions between Miller and Reynolds, who are both up for re-election in 2022, have momentarily cooled. In 2019, Reynolds considered a bill eliminating Miller's power to join multi-state lawsuits after Republicans expressed anger over his decision to challenge Trump administration policies on immigration and other topics. Reynolds vetoed the bill under a deal in which Miller agreed to not join lawsuits without her approval. Since then, Reynolds has rejected dozens of Miller's requests. Langholz listed Thompson as a reference last year when he applied for his dream job on the Iowa Supreme Court. A nominating commission didn't recommend Langholz as one of the 3 finalists for Reynolds' consideration after critics said he didn't have enough experience. Reynolds selected a different lawyer with longtime Republican ties. Langholz will get another chance to apply next year when the court's sole Democratic-appointed justice, Brent Appel, faces mandatory retirement. If appointed, he could serve 3 decades. Trump calls for unity at CPAC, and the story filed by the Associated Press opens with a photograph of a gentleman wearing a red shirt and a Make America Great Again hat. He's pointing his finger at someone and obviously yelling. And the caption to the picture says, a supporter of former President Donald Trump shouts at a demonstrator outside the convention center at the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, Sunday in Orlando, Florida. Orlando, Florida. Taking the stage for the first time since leaving office, former President Donald Trump on Sunday called for Republican Party unity even as he exacerbated intra-party divisions and trumpeted lies about the election in a speech that made clear he intends to remain a dominant political force. Speaking at the Conservative Political Action Conference, where he has been hailed as a returning hero, Trump blasted his successor, President Joe Biden, and tried to cement his status as the party's undisputed leader despite his loss in November. Quote, "Do you miss me yet?" Trump said after taking the stage, where his old rally soundtrack had been playing. Quote, "I stand before you today to declare that the incredible journey we begun together is far from being over," unquote. Though Trump has flirted with the idea of creating a third party, he pledged Sunday to remain part of what he called our beloved party. "I'm going to continue to fight right by your side. We're not starting new parties," he said. "We have the Republican Party. It's going to be strong and united like never before." The conference, held this year in Orlando instead of Washington suburbs because of the COVID-19 restrictions, has served as a tribute to Trump and Trumpism, complete with a golden statue in his likeness on display. Speakers, including many potential 2024 hopefuls, have argued the party must embrace the former president and his followers even after the deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, as they have repeated his unfounded claim that he lost the November election only because of mass voter fraud, an assertion that has been repeatedly rejected by judges, Republican state officials, and Trump's own administration. Still, Trump continued to repeat what Democrats have dubbed the big lie, calling the election rigged and insisting that he won in November, even though he lost by more than 7 million votes. Quote, "As you know, they just lost the White House," he said of Biden, rewriting history as he teased the prospect that he will run again in 2024. And he mocked those who have warned that such talk will damage the party. Quote, "If Republicans don't get this and other things I'm going to say, then you should, like the Supreme Court, be ashamed of yourselves," he said. The conference's annual unscientific straw poll of just over 1,000 attendees found that 97% approve of the job Trump did as president, but they were much more ambiguous about whether he should run again, with 68% saying that he should. If the 2024 primary were held today and Trump were in the race, just 55% said they would vote for him, followed by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis at 21%. Without Trump in the field, DeSantis garnered 43% support, followed by 8% for South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem and 7% each for former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Burial vault company workers do their best, filed by Jared McNett of the Globe Gazette. Mason City. Daniel Clark has spent 44 years making death a part of his life. When he started with the local branch of the Wilbert Burial Vault Company, a nondescript light brown building on an industrial stretch of 8th Street Southwest in Mason City, Clark was only in his early 20s. He took the job in part because it came recommended from a friend who worked there at the time and because he needed something that paid well to provide for his new wife. Clark stuck with it because of the sense of purpose the job offered. "I liked helping people out when making sure their last request was taken care of and the family members were all happy with whatever I did out there. I just tried to do my best for them," he told Mason City Globe Gazette. In the decades since Clark first started with Wilbert, which has operated in the U.S. since 1880 and has four plants in Iowa, he's been the one of the last ones to see the casket lowered for children, Navy SEALs, and even his wife. When he eventually goes, Clark said he intends to be buried in a high-strength, concrete, single-reinforced Venetian vault akin to his wife's. As Clark speaks out about the inevitability in a Chicago-style accent that's long on the letters A and O, he doesn't register as weary. Even with something as heavy as having to preside over the interment of a child, Clark offers context. Quote, "There's a reason why. We don't know why, but there's a reason," unquote, Clark said. Clark is semi-retired from Wilbert now, but still helps out plant manager Daniel Bowers however he can. Bowers, 34, hasn't been there 2 years, but already has picked up some of the same perspective that Clark has about making a product that's an integral part of the burial process. Quote, when I first started, it seemed kind of tough to see this family dealing with such a hard time, but you do see a lot of togetherness and support for each other, Bowers said. He recalled that a few days ago, a family was actually out at the cemetery just to see the vault sealed up. That day in particular was more difficult, Bowers admitted. Often the most difficult part of the work is some of the more technical stuff. Bowers, Clark, and their colleague Jonathan Rowe, who has been there a little less than a year, all acknowledge that hillside cemeteries are the toughest places to work in, especially one where the grave plots are close together, Clark said. Bowers noted the elements can be brutal to deal with as well. Cold days and rainy days are the toughest to make it through. And the days when machinery breaks down or graves start to cave in a bit. If there's any downtime, Bowers has tried in the past to take photos of graveyards he visits. He studied photography in college. That happens a little less now because Bowers has already photographed so many cemeteries in the area he covers. When Bowers wants to unwind from work, he said he spends as much time with his family as possible. Watching his kids play with Play-Doh is more than enough of a source of joy for him. He said that his children haven't gone with him on many trips to the cemetery, but that they do think the work is a bit strange. His wife has some context, though. She previously worked for Hogan Bremer Moore as a licensed funeral director. Quote, she saw a job come up and thought I'd be perfect for it, Bowers said. According to Bowers, exactly how many vaults are made in a week depends on how many services are scheduled in Wilbert's coverage area, which can sometimes stretch up to Minnesota and as far east in Iowa as Lansing on the Mississippi River. The crew aims to pour 7 vaults in a day, which takes 2 or 3 hours. The pour itself consists of concrete powder, chip rock, and sand. It takes another 12 or 16 hours for the burial vaults to set once they've been poured. And then the vaults might be in the warehouse for 30 days before they're sent out. Prior to departure, they can be stylized for specific people being buried. In a given month, Bowers figures that the crew makes 40 or 50 vaults. Quote, if we don't keep up on production, it can make things pretty difficult, Bowers said. With the way COVID has been, production has always been difficult with all the services we're doing. Per Clark, an 8 or 9 funeral day has happened before. That's when the work can really feel ratcheted up. But again, even the most difficult moments for Bowers, Clark, and Rowe are tempered by context, perspective, and time. Given long enough, some strange things can make more sense. When Clark was asked about whether or not it's eerie to open a grave back up, which he has to do a few things to help with autopsies, he simply responded, no, don't bother me none. Early into this time with Wilbert, Bowers had a job in West Union. While chatting with a gravedigger, Bowers got a piece of advice that stuck with him ever since. Quote, just remember, no matter what happens in the day, we bury our problems here, unquote. Father of drug sentencing reformer faces prison. Filed by Ryan Foley of the Associated Press. Iowa City. When he was the top federal prosecutor in southern Iowa, Nick Kleinfeld won praise for reducing the use of mandatory minimum sentencing and enhancements that he argued put too many nonviolent drug offenders in prison for too long. Now, the office that Kleinfeld once led is using those tools against his 74-year-old father, Michael, who faces a mandatory prison sentence of 10 years if convicted on drug charges that were brought this month. Michael Kleinfeld was sentenced in 2003 to a mandatory 10-year term after he was convicted of a low-level meth offense, a punishment that has been credited with helping shape his son's advocacy for what he calls a smarter, fairer approach. He was midway through his sentence when President Barack Obama in 2009 nominated Nick Kleinfeld, a defense lawyer with ties to the Democratic Party, to be U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Iowa. Nick Kleinfeld led the Des Moines-based office until his stepping down in late 2015. During his tenure, he worked to enact Department of Justice's policy changes that encouraged prosecutors to avoid triggering mandatory minimum sentences and reduce the use of sentence enhancements for prior convictions. Those changes were particularly impactful in Iowa, where prosecutors previously had one of the nation's highest rates of securing mandatory minimum sentences in drug cases, and usually sought enhancements when they could. During the Trump administration, the Department of Justice resumed seeking lengthy prison sentences in such cases under Attorney General Jeff Sessions. A criminal justice reform law signed by Trump in 2018 reduced but did not eliminate mandatory minimums and enhancements. In a 2018 op-ed piece, Nicholas Kleinfeld said his experience showed that many federal drug defendants are addicts trying to support their habits by selling small amounts of drugs to other users. He noted that a conviction for intent to distribute 5 grams of methamphetamine, the weight of a nickel, triggers a 5-year minimum sentence. That's precisely the law the U.S. Attorney's Office used to charge Michael Kleinfeld in an indictment returned by a grand jury earlier this month. Michael Kleinfeld came under scrutiny in December when he was a passenger in a vehicle that fled from police during a traffic stop. Police say they found meth, cash, and 2 guns in a backpack, all of which he denied knowledge of. He faces state charges of possessing a gun as a felon from that incident. Des Moines police officers executed a warrant at Michael Kleinfeld's home in January. They found 29.5 grams of methamphetamine in his bedroom closet, $653 cash in his wallet, Ziploc bags, and other paraphernalia, evidence consistent with what a drug trafficker would have if he also uses some of his own supply, an investigator said in a criminal complaint. Polk County turned over the case to federal prosecutors who sought the indictment and immediately requested a sentencing enhancement, citing Kleinfeld's 2003 conviction. That means he faces 10 years to life in prison if he's convicted. Michael Kleinfeld has been temporarily jailed pending a detention hearing next week. A federal judge from outside Iowa has been assigned to handle the case to avoid conflicts of interest. Michael Kleinfeld left prison in 2011 and was transferred to a Des Moines halfway house where he completed his sentence in 2012. He stayed out of trouble for years while on supervised release, which a judge ended 4 years early in 2016 at his request so that he could apply to have his voting rights restored before the presidential election. His attorney, Angela Campbell, noted that Kleinfeld would not have qualified for the enhancement that extended his sentence to 10 years under reforms enacted by President Barack Obama's administration. He wasn't a leader of the conspiracy. His offense didn't involve violence. He had a minor criminal history, and his offense was very low level, involving just over 5 grams of methamphetamine. Nicholas Kleinfeld, who recently led an investigation into the botched 2020 Iowa caucuses for the state Democratic Party, declined to comment about his father's case. A spokeswoman for the U.S. Attorney's Office, which is headed by Acting U.S. Attorney Richard Westphal, also declined to comment. President Joe Biden has not yet nominated someone to lead the office permanently. Now on the sports page, in women's college volleyball, Sycamores rally past Panthers in 5 sets. The story is filed by Gunnar Davis and begins with a photograph of Coach Peterson. Sunday night's Missouri Valley Conference volleyball matchup between University of Northern Iowa and Indiana State at the McLeod Center was a tale of 2 matches. After 2 wins and 2 sets, the Panthers looked like they were going to run away with it, but the Sycamores roared back and won the next 2 sets to send the match to game-deciding 5th set. The Sycamores earned 15-5 dominant 5th set win to pull off a 3-2 comeback victory. The loss for the Panthers marked the first time in program history that Indiana State visited Cedar Falls and earned a win. For UNI head coach Bobby Peterson, the loss is another learning moment for her young team. But she doesn't want to use her team's youth as an excuse for the loss. Quote, "I don't give it an out," Peterson said. "We've been playing. We've had so many matches under our belt now. So yes, we're a young team, but we're not as young as when we started. Some of those things, they have to change. We're going to decide if they're going to change," unquote. The Panthers looked like they were setting the tone early, jumping out to a 1-0 match lead with a 25-15 dominant first set win. UNI followed it up with a 25-18 win in the second set. Sophomore Kalissa Andorfer was on the attack early, delivering 9 kills between the first two sets. But the Sycamores looked like a completely different team to start the third set. The visitors jumped out to a 16-10 lead and rode the newfound momentum to shock the Panthers and earn the first set win of the comeback 25-16. Quote, "I definitely feel like it was more of a momentum thing," junior Inga Rodo said. Quote, "They just had the energy. They were just getting some really good plays, and we just weren't bouncing back from it," unquote. Up until Sunday night's game, the Panthers had won the last nine matches against the Sycamores. Based off recent history alone, fans wouldn't have been wrong to expect UNI to bounce back in the fourth set and win the match. Instead, it was the Sycamores who doubled down and scored second straight 25-16 win. Indiana State followed it up with a convincing 15-5 fifth set win to prove the match victory wasn't a fluke. Quote, "As the match went on, I thought they did a better job of defending us instead of, on our side, being a little more patient with what we were doing," Peterson said. "We got forced into making some frustrating swings and trying to hit shots that I think were available earlier, but then they closed in and read pretty easily. Good defensive teams, that's what they do. They frustrate you," unquote. Rodo led the Panthers offensively with 14 kills. Andorfer finished with 12 kills, while freshman Yangmar Sinel had 10 kills. Recent MVC Freshman of the Week winner Taylor Alden had 44 assists and 21 digs. The Panthers are now 5-7 overall and 5-4 in conference play. The squad will have a short turnaround to try to avenge the loss against the Sycamores. UNI plays on Monday night in the second half of the doubleheader against Indiana State in Cedar Falls. Quote, "I think it's really important to let it hurt a bit, for sure, and go back and watch film," junior Carly Spies said. But then kind of get over it, make the adjustments that we need to, because it's a new game. Tonight doesn't matter. So we've got to figure out what changes we need to make to come out stronger tomorrow night," unquote. In golf, Woods breaks silence 5 days after the crash. The story is filed by Nancy Dillon of the New York Daily News, and it begins with a photograph of the wrecked car being lifted out by a crane, and there's extensive damage to the car, both front end and sides and back end. Tiger Woods broke his silence Sunday to say he's going through a tough time after his near-fatal car crash, but was deeply moved by fellow pro golfers and fans wearing his trademark red. Quote, "It is hard to explain how touching today was when I turned on the TV and saw all the red shirts," he said in a Twitter post Sunday evening, the first post on his account in his own voice since the rollover crash. "To every golfer and every fan, you are truly helping me get through this tough time," he tweeted. Rory McIlroy, Patrick Reed, Tommy Fleetwood, and Cameron Champ were among the many players and fans to wear red shirts and black pants to show their support for Woods on the final day of the WGC Workday Championship at the Concession. Woods, 45, has been recovering from emergency surgery after his terrifying Tuesday morning crash on the border of Rancho Palos Verdes and Rolling Hills Estates in Los Angeles County left him pinned in a badly mangled 2021 Genesis GV80 SUV. The golf legend was driving from his hotel to a morning photo shoot when he lost control of the vehicle traveling down a steep hill, hit a median, crossed two lanes of oncoming traffic, and rolled multiple times before finally coming to a stop on an embankment. The cause of the wreck remains under investigation, Los Angeles County Sheriff Alex Villanueva said during a Facebook live chat. Quote, "We don't contemplate any charges whatsoever in this crash," Villanueva said. "This remains an accident. An accident is not a crime," unquote. Authorities have said Woods did not appear intoxicated at the scene, so investigators will need to come up with a probable cause to get a search warrant to test any blood drawn from Woods at the hospital, Villanueva said. Medical experts, meanwhile, believe Woods' recovery will be long and arduous, likely taking a year. Woods' official Twitter account previously said he suffered significant injuries to his right lower leg. Comminuted open fractures affecting both the upper and lower portions of the tibia and fibula bones were stabilized by inserting a rod into the tibia, the statement said. Quote, "Additional injuries to the bones of the foot and ankle were stabilized with a combination of screws and pins," it said, adding that surgeons had to release pressure caused by trauma to his muscles and soft tissue. Quote, "I think he's probably in for a long recovery. Anytime someone has this type of open fracture that's comminuted and requires a fasciotomy to release pressure on the muscles, it signifies how much trauma there was to the limb," Dr. Jeremy Polonick, an orthopedic surgeon at Mount Sinai Hospital in Manhattan, told the news. Quote, "It could take a year for Tiger to return to his prior function," Dr. Polonick said. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, March 1st. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And you may wish to stay tuned to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which follows shortly. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.